MC Fontaine here. This episode of the podcast is dedicated to the memory of Mick Chalkley, who recently passed away at the age of 92. During World War II, he served in the Fleet Air Arm. A large part of this, he was on escort duty on the Russian and Malta convoys, amongst others. He was really fascinated when I explained to him some of the work that Bletchley Park did during the war, and like me, he had no doubt that they must have helped in some way to keep him safe and to live through the war, so that I'd eventually get to call him my stepdad. Thank you.
From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the February edition of the Bletchley Park podcast with me, Catherine Lynch. Captain Jerry Roberts was a founding member of the Testery, who worked with Bill Tutt breaking into Lorentz, which the Codebreakers called Tunny. He's been calling for better recognition of what his colleagues achieved for more than 4 years. At the turn of the year, he was honoured with an MBE. We caught up with him at home in Surrey after being kindly invited for a lavish lunch with him and his wife, May. I asked Captain Roberts how he felt after more than 4 years of campaigning to be honoured for his efforts.
This is ITV, you understand?
Yes. There's been a great deal of interest in recent years, and now recognition of how hard you've worked to generate and sustain that interest in the MBE.
Well, yes. The actual citation of my award refers to the promotion that I've done at Bletchley Park, rather than the work I did during the war.
Does that seem odd, given the importance of what you did during the war?
That's exactly a good way of putting it. You know, it was important work. The Russians could have lost at Kursk. We could have lost on D-Day. All the decrypts that we had helped against those things.
So let's go back to 2003, when information about Tunny started to become declassified. What made you sort of prick your ears up and realise things were changing and you would start to be able to tell the story?
Well, I was quite astonished because for all that length of time, I hadn't thought about Bletchley Park at all. Hadn't crossed my mind. It was just something that happened in the dim and distant past, almost to somebody else, you know.
Must have taken on a sense of unreality those war years, almost within the context of the rest of your career. Because it was so unusual.
It was very special.
Yeah.
It was very special. The fact that you couldn't tell anybody about it, and the fact that from what you'd seen, you realised it was so confidential and so important. It was strange not to be able to talk about it. And of course, I didn't. In that year, 2003, my wife May knew that I'd worked at Bletchley Park. But I hadn't told her what I'd worked on. In other words, on Tunny. That was still classified, but I didn't tell her. And we were very close. Tell each other everything. Nearly everything.
So you must have then started to tell her what you'd done. She must have been fascinated to start to hear details. Because she's one of the almost passionate advocates with you of this story to make sure people know.
She is completely, indeed, all the emails, all the letters, fixing all the appointments, arranging the transport and travel. It's endless, a lot of work, and she's done it so well.
Now, 2003, there's a gap, really, before you began your campaign in earnest. So what led you in, about 2008, to really get going? 2007.
Professor Jack Copeland. Who wrote the book, which was published in 2006, and he invited me to write a chapter for it, which I did. And then in 2007, on a very dark November night, he and I gave a joint talk at Bletchley Park, He had 40 minutes and I had 40 minutes. And that was the start of it all, you know.
And you haven't stopped since?
No.
You're not ready to until...
Absolutely not.
Until you feel the story's
better told.
There's always been plenty to do.
So when you really got going in 2007 and started giving talks and campaigning, did you set out with a clear vision at that point? And has it grown in recent years? The passion you have is incredible for spreading the word about this important aspect of...
And it'd be nice to say yes. The reality is that it grew like topsy. The UCL opportunity came along, and then one of my business contacts heard about it and invited me to talk to about 80 people from his clients and from his staff. Then there was another, the big UCL one, with 500 people. You never expected there to be another one after that, but there always was. And on Thursday next, I'll be doing number 18.
How do you feel personally about the honour you've received, now that the dust's settled a little?
Well, an honour is an honour. And the opportunity to meet Her Majesty again is a great bonus. The first time I met her and talked with her, she was absolutely charming, wonderful person, and I'd love to meet her again.
There was quite some fuss when it was announced over Christmas. There was some quite strongly felt public reaction that it wasn't
quite
enough.
Naturally.
How did that feel?
I was delighted because I felt strongly myself. This is wrong. I feel I represent not just myself. I don't mind what honour I get. I don't even mind if I don't get one. I lived without one for 92 years. I can manage a bit more, hopefully. But I feel I represent the testary, and they did a fantastic job. And an MBE is not a fantastic decoration.
Before we hear more from Captain Roberts, let's look ahead at some forthcoming events at Bletchley Park. On Valentine's Day, we welcome Paul Rimmer for the next in the Winter Lecture Series. He'll give a talk on intelligence assessments then and now, looking at what's changed since World War II. And in March, we host a full day's worth of eminent speakers for an event on the 16th, commemorating the 70th anniversary of the Battle of the Atlantic. Bletchley Park's £7.4 million Heritage Lottery-funded restoration programme is underway in earnest now. There are nearly 18 months of building work ahead all over the site, and that's only the beginning. I caught up with the CEO of the Bletchley Park Trust, Ian Standen, who's overseeing this project, in one of the buildings set to be restored, Hut 6. So we're in Hut 6, which is atmospherically damp, dank and dingy, but of course it's a historic exhibit in itself and must be treated with great respect. So what are we doing in here for a start?
Well, Hut 6 and Hut 3 together are both going to be restored sympathetically, which means that they'll have the planks taken out of them, examined if they're fit for purpose, they get back in. If they're not, they'll be replaced. And all the fixtures and fittings we put back in as close as we can to the 1940s fixtures and fittings that we used here. And the odd brick walls you see here, that's still part of the sort of fabric of the building.
I think there's a surprise for you every time you come in somewhere like this, that something you didn't know about the way either it's been altered post-war or the original fabric of the building, like, for example, brick walls.
Indeed, yes, it's quite strange, absolutely. Yes, not quite sure why that was. I guess proof of structure and integrity of the buildings. That's sort of the joy for the architects, to make sure we understand exactly what parts were here and which parts weren't.
How good are the records on exactly how it was fitted out? Has there been some surmise in establishing that?
Like a lot of things, I think we're taking some guesses in certain places, but they were built to a fairly standard design. We know the materials they were built out of, and we have a number of floor plans of the huts at the time, so we know what the various rooms were used for and which rooms are post-war and which were original in the 1940s.
And as much as we know and can establish, we'll take it right back to the materials that would have been here, for example, however the walls would have been covered, however the floors would have been arranged. and the light switches and all those kind of fittings.
Best we can, we'll try and uncover the materials that were used. Clearly some things we know absolutely, apparently it was Canadian pine used. And other bits for the walls and the fixtures and fittings, absolutely. We'll try and replicate the Second World War feeling as much as we can. And where we can source the original material, we'll try and get it.
The reason for doing all this, of course, is to bring it to life for visitors and take you back to what it would have been like. So what we want to create is the atmosphere and, you know, something of the contents and the feel of the buildings as they were. And that's less about fixtures and fittings and what the pipes are made of, and more about really set dressing. So we're going to have some quite creative things going on there, aren't we?
It's what's called light touch interpretation, and it means getting as much of the feeling about what it was like in here as the buildings themselves, which means in some rooms you may have a properly dressed room laid out as it was an office at the time. Others you might just have a bit of sound, a bit of visual, perhaps even some smell, so you can understand what it was like. And they were pretty rudimentary conditions of working. If you happened to have a stove in your room, you were right, kept you warm. If not, you were quite cold. And of course, we're looking out the window here, but in the wartime, out the windows, you couldn't see because they were either blacked out or there were blast walls on the outside to stop shrapnel from bombs perforating the building. So quite a dark environment of working in.
And it's exciting to think that we'll be able to bring visitors into here and they can absorb the atmosphere and understand better and get a feeling for what was happening in here during those crucial war years. But of course, looking over the next 18 months, we've had hugely increasing visitor numbers in the last few years, and we want to keep that going, but we're going to have some logistical difficulties getting everybody around the building work. What do you think brings the biggest challenge in that?
Well, the biggest challenge probably is that the huts we're standing in will have to be shrouded, I suspect, when we do the work, so scaffolding over them and some sort of covering so they can be taken apart without the wind and weather getting at them. And that'll inevitably mean we'll have to impinge on the roads, so that's going to cause a bit of a problem. But the way the project is structured, in that there are three stages to it, three elements to it, are done in a deliberate order, allows us to minimise the impact. We'll construct new car parks at the periphery of the site for a start, which allows us to move cars from the centre of the park to the outside, so that'll help. And then we then move on to restoring the huts and also looking at Boxy and your visitor centre. So our project manager is looking at the logistics and the operational impact of it, and I hope that we'll have minimum disruption to our visitors.
Speaking of disruption, we've had a couple of weeks of really rotten weather already this year, and we don't know that that's the end of it. Has it slowed things down, and are there contingencies in place for that, or is it just see what comes?
Nothing at the moment. No, we haven't started the building work. The building work's not due to start until the end of March, around Easter time, once we've got the contractors on the team. And there is a little bit of slippage room in the programme allowed for those unforeseen circumstances. And you'll always get those in a project, whether it's weather, whether it's uncovering things, you start to take things out, and that's built into the programme. So we're still looking at a soft opening at Easter 2014 and a hard opening on D-Day in June 2014.
And then the real work begins, because then it's the next phase of fundraising.
Indeed, yeah.
This is only the beginning.
It doesn't stop. We only touch sort of three elements with this project, and we move forward to look at the rest of the site and continue the transformation of Bletchley Park to a world-class heritage site.
Fingers crossed that it all runs smoothly.
Absolutely, and we'll keep you updated as we go throughout the year on the project as it progresses.
We'll bring you much more on this. Shall we have a wander up this corridor? I can show you some of the different wall coverings and the floors.
When veterans visit Bletchley Park, it's fascinating to find out what they did here. In Nancy Jackson's case, it wasn't quite what she thought. Like many who worked here, she didn't know how her specific job fitted into the code-breaking operation. It turned out she'd worked in the Newmanry, the section led by Max Newman, to develop machines which would take the work of the testery where senior cryptographers, including Captain Jerry Roberts, broke into Lorentz by hand and speed up the process. She's described herself as a tiny cog.
When you came here today, what was the first thing that came flooding back to you?
The entrance to the main building, because I did remember that. It's very different inside now, because that was where we used to come for our meal breaks and our sort of half hour off.
Do you remember much of the social life and the people you met?
I didn't have much social life at Bletchley Park at all. I just came to work, and I was brought by coach from Roban Abbey, which is where we were billeted. And then I was collected at the end of my 8 hours or 9 hours, whichever it was, and went back again.
Do you recall how you were recruited?
I was a wren.
And the first 2 weeks of life in being a wren, you go to a big establishment called Mill Hill, and you were a pro wren, and you went through the things like having to sign the Official Secret Act, and you signed allegiance to the Queen, and I think they already knew. I'd actually got higher school certificate maths, so they said, well, I was obviously quite good at maths. I said, well, that's the only qualification I've got.
And you probably hadn't realised how useful that was going to be in the war effort at that stage.
Well, it actually wasn't particularly, because what I did was so repetitive and so much the same thing the whole time I was on the 8 hours in the little hut that we worked in. I forget which hut it was now. And we would come in from the coach, come in to take over from the previous people who handed us a sheet with numbers on it, and we would just work through these numbers. And what we were really doing was being a tiny cog, making up a computer, doing the permutations and commutations. And the people who brought them to us from the senior department, the boffins, if you like, would come and collect them from time to time and bring us some more, and we just go on doing that.
How much of a sense of context did you have? How your part fitted into the larger machine, if you like?
Really? Very little, because you knew so little about anybody else. Nobody talked about what they did. Nobody asked what anybody else did. You just didn't mention it. And the only thing, when I was in uniform, which of course I wasn't all the time I was coming and going, was the fact that on my headband, around the hat, instead of saying HMS Dreadnought, it said SDX, which was Special Duties X. And we could actually say that, I think I must have been able to, because I'm sure my parents would have asked me when I went home. My sisters would have asked me.
But you must have been very limited in what you could tell people. Do you remember when it started to come out?
1980.
And did you share with people in your life then what you'd done?
Oh, yes. They were interested then as to what I had done. But I didn't, in a way, realise the enormity, the importance as to what I had done. Churchill said things like the fact that it shortened the war by about 2 years and saved a number of lives, that sort of thing.
It must have been hard in the first sort of 10 to 20 years after the war, before it all started to come out, to know that you played an important part, you made a contribution, but not to be able to share that. Because everybody was defined to a degree by what they'd done in the war, yes. Weren't they?
Yes, I knew it was still SDX up to the end of 1980, and then it was sort of released.
What sort of impression have you got today, visiting now, and seeing the sort of the bigger picture?
The complexity of it. I was interested in the Admiral, I forget his name now, who came down from Whitehall, who was a senior admiral, and was also apparently interested in code-breaking, I think. And he had thought that they wouldn't be able to remain in London doing their work there because they couldn't be vulnerable to bombing, and which London obviously was going to be. And so he had worked out that Bletchley Park was an ideal geographical place, if you like. It was on a direct road to London. It had a direct rail link, not only with London, but also with Oxford and Cambridge. And they knew they were going to need to have a large amount of help from Oxford and Cambridge, particularly the mathematicians, of course. I thought that was quite interesting. I was interested also to hear about, there was a family living in the house.
Yes, Bud, yeah.
Four children, and he was in charge of transport. He was pointing out how important it was because there are three ways of entering, and he'd got coaches and people being billeted all around Bedfordshire and quite a wide radius, all coming in, and sometimes a large number of them at a time. And he needed to make certain that they didn't sort of cross over with each other.
It's quite a logistical operation, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
It was a factory, really, wasn't it? A code-breaking factory, running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
I suppose, yes, it was, really.
What did you go on to do after the war?
I went to university and failed my first degree and met my future husband. And then I moved to the north of Scotland to live there with him for his first 2 years after we were married. Then he had transferred to Nottingham University, and they took me back. I was lucky because coming out of the forces, I had a grant, so I'd used up that grant. But they treated me like the daughter of a member of staff instead of his wife, and they paid too, so that was good.
What did you study?
Zoology.
A bit different from maths, then.
Rather, yes. We had lived in Nigeria for 5 years, and I had a research job with the principal, who was quite a senior entomologist. He'd also been involved in the judgments at the Nuremberg trials, so he was an interesting man to know. I worked for him part-time, then I had 2 children out there, then I had servants to look after the children. I could work part-time, still back in the lab, till we came home.
Well, thank you ever so much for sharing.
That's fine.
Let's go back now to Captain Jerry Roberts, a senior cryptographer who worked in the testery, breaking Lorentz messages sent by Hitler and the High Command. He's been awarded the MBE for his work promoting the codebreakers of Bletchley Park. At the heart of his campaign are Alan Turing, Bill Tutt and Tommy Flowers, who he describes as great men who achieved great things but haven't been treated like great men. I asked Captain Roberts what he would like to see come out of his ongoing efforts to achieve better recognition of his colleagues' immense successes.
You do have very much a fire in your belly to make sure that people understand the importance of the work carried out. The effort you've gone to spread the word has got its own momentum. I think demand will keep growing. And the four T's you talk of. Turing, much better recognised than when you set out. Tut, not yet, but getting there. Tommy Flowers a little bit more. And the testery not enough.
But Tut and Tommy Flowers hardly anything. The only person who's been promoting Bill Tutt is myself, because I believe he deserves it. His achievement was astonishing. General Eisenhower, after the war, said Bletchley Decrypt shortened the war by at least 2 years. Do you know how many people died each year? 10 million. And what I don't understand is that any other country would be proud of these people and would cry their achievements from the rooftops. Here, for whatever reason, it is a phenomenon and I don't understand it. People will praise Montgomery for winning this battle and winning that battle. They will give him titles and medals. Cryptographers who did things sometimes more important than Montgomery did get nothing. Let's give a comparison. Wellington, who served the country well after Waterloo, was created Duke of Wellington and given one Piccadilly place, big house in London. A century before, John Churchill did the same. He fought various battles. The last one was Blenheim. He was given Blenheim Palace, 64 acres. Do you know what reward Alan Turing got? A bonus of £200 and an OBE. Unbelievable. Do you know what Tommy Flowers got? He got an innovation award of £1,000. I know it's worth more than them, not that much. And he'd already been made an MBE. He had to sit and suffer while people like Bill Gates made fortunes. And Tut? Absolutely nothing. To this day, nothing. It's a national scandal.
Do you think it's too late to adequately honour Bill Tut for what he achieved, given that he seems to be the least well recognised of your colleagues?
Any honour is an honour. If it comes late, that's bad, that's too bad. But it is our defect that we haven't done it already.
If you've made some progress of getting people to get behind the importance of what was achieved and appreciate it a bit better.
In fairness, I don't think they know the full story. And then they didn't try to find out either.
You've been chipping away more and more into the public consciousness and awareness of what was achieved and the complexity of it. Alan Turing's become quite a famous name in recent years, especially this last year, his centenary year. Do you perhaps welcome some of the attention that his life and work has received as a portal for people to find out more about the rest of it?
I think it will happen slowly. I'm doing my best to make it happen fast. Tut's birthday is 5 years from now. Have we got to wait till then? I would say to the authorities, it's a scandal, you've done nothing. Get on with it. Give him a posthumous knighthood. And if you can't do that, it's your job to think of something else you can do. The responsibility is yours. Get on with it.
There's no overnight fix, is there, unfortunately, to make people realise the importance. There's no one documentary or website or museum exhibit that can hammer it into the public consciousness.
Well, bear in mind the film did. For those people who saw the film, and I've estimated there were about 4 million.
The BBC programme, The Lost Heroes of Bletchley Park, that you took part in.
Small correction. It wasn't a BBC programme. It was a BBC Wales programme.
Oh. I think it's the complexity of it. So sometimes scientific information is boiled down to such a degree in the media and made so easy. I wonder if that's part of the challenge you've faced in recent years.
I understand what you mean, but I don't present it that way. For me, the big question is, did it make any difference? And it made a huge difference. And this is what people should take note of first. And that usually puts a different aspect on the whole thing. What can we do about it? We have these three men, whom I call the three heroes of Bletchley Park. Turing, Tutt, and Tommy Flowers. Turing stopped not just Britain but Europe being plunged into 50 years of a Nazi dark age. Tutt helped greatly to shorten the war. Tommy Flowers has laid the foundation of everything that's happened on the computer world internationally. These were great men, and they have not been treated like great men. They did great things, achieved great things. I would like to suggest a joint statue on that fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square. That's if David Beckham doesn't mind.
They were great men, but you now champion their cause, and you are their greatest advocate.
Absolutely.
And you must not underestimate the value of how much you've done to bring them to public attention.
Well,
and you may not be where you want to be with it, but you've come
it's
a very long way.
It's something. There's a lot more we need to do. We just keep plugging away.
We will. We will. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for giving the time, both of you.
It's an honour, Jerry. Thank you for sharing.
And in the next Bletchley Park podcast extra, you can hear more from Captain Jerry Roberts, giving us a rare insight into his work after the war with the War Crimes Investigation Unit and trailblazing in the marketing industry. Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @BParkPodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.